What is termed disease does not exist. It is neither mind nor matter. The belief of sin, which has grown terrible in strength and influence, is an unconscious error in the beginning, an embryonic thought without motive, but afterwards it governs the so-called man. Passion, depraved appetites, dishonesty, envy, hatred, revenge ripens into action, only to pass from shame and woe to their final punishment. Mortal existence is a dream of pain and pleasure in matter, a dream of sin, sickness, and death, and it is like the dream we have in sleep, in which everyone recognizes his condition to be wholly a state of mind. In both the waking and the sleeping dream, the dreamer thinks that his body is material and the suffering is in that body. The smile of the sleeper indicates the sensation produced physically by the pleasure of a dream. In the same way, pain and pleasure, sickness and care, are traced upon mortals by unmistakable signs. Sickness is a growth of error springing from mortal ignorance or fear. Error rehearses error. What causes disease cannot cure it. The soil of disease is mortal mind, and you have an abundant or scanty crop of disease according to the seedlings of fear. Sin and the fear of disease must be uprooted and cast out. When darkness comes over the earth, the physical senses have no immediate evidence of a sun. The human eye knows not where the orb of day is, nor if it exists. Astronomy gives the desired information regarding the sun. The human or material senses yield to the authority of this science, and they are willing to leave with astronomy the explanation of the sun's influence over the earth. If the eyes see no sun for a week, we still believe that there is solar light and heat. Science, in this instance named natural, raises the human thought above the cruder theories of the human mind and casts out a fear. In like manner, mortals should no more deny the power of Christian science to establish harmony and to explain the effect of mortal mind on the body, though the cause be unseen, than they should deny the existence of the sunlight when the orb of day disappears, or doubt that the sun will reappear. The sins of others should not make good men suffer. We call the body material, but it is as truly mortal mind, according to its degree, as is the material brain, which is supposed to furnish the evidence of all mortal thought or things. The human mortal mind, by an inevitable perversion, makes all things start from the lowest instead of from the highest mortal thought. The reverse is the case with all the formations of the immortal divine mind. They proceed from the divine source, and so in tracing them, we constantly ascend in infinite being. From mortal mind comes the reproduction of the species. First the belief of inanimate and then of animate matter. According to mortal thought, the development of embryonic mortal mind commences in the lower basal portion of the brain and goes on in an ascending scale by evolution, keeping always in the direct line of matter, for matter is the subjective condition of mortal mind. Next, we have the formation of so-called embryonic mortal mind. Afterwards, mortal men or mortals. All this while matter is a belief, ignorant of itself, ignorant of what it is supposed to produce. The mortal says that an inanimate, unconscious seedling is producing mortals, both body and mind. And yet neither a mortal mind nor the immortal mind is found in brain or elsewhere in matter or in mortals. This embryonic and materialistic human belief called mortal man in turn fills itself with thoughts of pain and pleasure, of life and death, and arranges itself into five so-called senses, which presently measure mind by the size of a brain and the bulk of a body called man. Human birth, growth, maturity, and decay are as the grass springing from the soil with beautiful green blades, afterwards to wither and return to its native nothingness. This mortal seeming is temporal. It never merges into immortal being, but finally disappears, and immortal man, spiritual and eternal, is found to be the real man. The Hebrew bard, swayed by mortal thoughts, thus swept his lyre with saddening strains on human existence. As for man, his days are as grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourisheth. For the wind passeth over it, and it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more. When hope rose higher in the human heart, he sang, As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness. For with thee is the fountain of life. In thy light shall we see light. The brain can give no idea of God's man. It can take no cognizance of mind. Matter is not the organ of infinite mind. As mortals give up the delusion that there is more than one mind, more than one God, man in God's likeness will appear. And this eternal man will include in that likeness no material element. As a material, theoretical life basis is found to be a misapprehension of existence. The spiritual and divine principle of man dawns upon human thought and leads it to where the young child was, even to the birth of a new old idea, to the spiritual sense of being and of what life includes. Thus the whole earth will be transformed by truth on its pinions of light, chasing away the darkness of error. The human thought must free itself from self-imposed materiality and bondage. It should no longer ask of the head, heart, or lungs, What are man's prospects for life? Mind is not helpless. Intelligence is not mute before non-intelligence. By its own volition, not a blade of grass springs up, not a spray buds within the veil, not a leaf unfolds its fair outlines, not a flower starts from its cloistered cell. The science of being reveals man and immortality as based on spirit. Physical sense defines mortal man as based on matter, and from this premise infers the mortality of the body. The elusive senses may fancy affinities with their opposites, but in Christian Science, truth never mingles with error. Mind has no affinity with matter, and therefore truth is able to cast out the ills of the flesh. Mind, God, sends forth the aroma of spirit, the atmosphere of intelligence. The belief that a pulpy substance under the skull is mind is a mockery of intelligence, a mimicry of mind. We are Christian scientists only as we quit our reliance upon that which is false and grasp the true. We are not Christian scientists until we leave all for Christ. Human opinions are not spiritual. They come from the hearing of the ear, from corporeality instead of from principle, and from the mortal instead of from the immortal. Spirit is not separate from God. Spirit is God. Erring power is a material belief, a blind, miscalled force, the offspring of will and not of wisdom, of the mortal mind and not of the immortal. It is the headlong cataract, the devouring flame, the tempest's breath. It is lightning and hurricane, all that is selfish, wicked, dishonest, and impure. Moral and spiritual might belong to spirit, who holds the wind in his fists, and this teaching accords with science and harmony. In science, you can have no power opposed to God, and the physical senses must give up their false testimony. Your influence for good depends upon the weight you throw into the right scale. The good you do and embody gives you the only power obtainable. Evil is not power. It is a mockery of strength, which ere long betrays its weakness and falls, never to rise. We walk in the footsteps of truth and love by following the example of our Master in the understanding of divine metaphysics. Christianity is the basis of true healing. Whatever holds human thought in line with unselfed love receives directly the divine power. I was called to visit Mr. Clark in Lynn, who had been confined to his bed 6 months with hip disease, caused by a fall upon a wooden spike when quite a boy. On entering the house, I met his physician, who said that the patient was dying. The physician had just probed the ulcer on the hip and said the bone was carious for several inches. He even showed me the probe, which had on it the evidence of this condition of the bone. The doctor went out. Mr. Clark lay with his eyes fixed and sightless. The dew of death was on his brow. I went to his bedside. In a few moments his face changed. Its death pallor gave place to a natural hue. The eyelids closed gently and the breathing became natural. He was asleep. In about 10 minutes he opened his eyes and said, "I feel like a new man. My suffering is all gone." It was between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon when this took place. I told him to rise, dress himself, and take supper with his family. He did so. The next day I saw him in the yard. Since then I have not seen him, but am informed that he went to work in 2 weeks. The discharge from the sore stopped, and the sore was healed. The diseased condition had continued there ever since the injury was received in boyhood. Since his recovery, I have been informed that his physician claims to have cured him, and that his mother has been threatened with incarceration in an insane asylum for saying, "It was none other than God and that woman who healed him." I cannot attest the truth of that report, but what I saw and did for that man and what his physician said of the case occurred just as I have narrated. It has been demonstrated to me that life is God, and that the might of omnipotent spirit shares not its strength with matter or with human will. Reviewing this brief experience, I cannot fail to discern the coincidence of the spiritual idea of man with the divine mind. A change in human belief changes all the physical symptoms and determines a case for better or for worse. When one's false belief is corrected, truth sends a report of health over the body. Destruction of the auditory nerve and paralysis of the optic nerve are not necessary to ensure deafness and blindness. For if mortal mind says, "I am deaf and blind," it will be so without an injured nerve. Every theory opposed to this fact, as I learned in metaphysics, would presuppose man, who is immortal in spiritual understanding, a mortal in material belief. The authentic history of Caspar Hauser is a useful hint as to the frailty and inadequacy of mortal mind. It proves beyond a doubt that education constitutes this so-called mind, and that in turn, mortal mind manifests itself in the body by the false sense it imparts. Incarcerated in a dungeon, where neither sight nor sound could reach him, at the age of 17, Caspar was still a mental infant, crying and chattering with no more intelligence than a babe, and realizing Tennyson's description, "An infant crying in the night, an infant crying for the light, and with no language but a cry." His case proves material sense to be but a belief formed by education alone. The light which affords us joy gave him a belief of intense pain. His eyes were inflamed by the light. After the babbling boy had been taught to speak a few words, he asked to be taken back to his dungeon and said that he should never be happy elsewhere. Outside of dismal darkness and cold silence, he found no peace. Every sound convulsed him with anguish. All that he ate, except his black crust, produced violent retchings. All that gives pleasure to our educated senses gave him pain through those very senses, trained in an opposite direction. The point for each one to decide is whether it is mortal mind or immortal mind that is causative. We should forsake the basis of matter for metaphysical science and its divine principle. Whatever furnishes the semblance of an idea governed by its principle furnishes food for thought. Through astronomy, natural history, chemistry, music, mathematics, thought passes naturally from effect back to cause. Academics of the right sort are requisite. Observation, invention, study, and original thought are expansive and should promote the growth of mortal mind out of itself, out of all that is mortal. It is the tangled barbarisms of learning which we deplore, the mere dogma, the speculative theory, the nauseous fiction. Novels, remarkable only for their exaggerated pictures, impossible ideals, and specimens of depravity, fill our young readers with wrong tastes and sentiments. Literary commercialism is lowering the intellectual standard to accommodate the purse and to meet a frivolous demand for amusement instead of for improvement. Incorrect views lower the standard of truth. If materialistic knowledge is power, it is not wisdom. It is but a blind force. Man has sought out many inventions, but he has not yet found it true that knowledge can save him from the dire effects of knowledge. The power of mortal mind over its own body is little understood. Better the suffering which awakens mortal mind from its fleshly dream than the false pleasures which tend to perpetuate this dream. Sin alone brings death, for sin is the only element of destruction. Fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell, said Jesus. A careful study of this text shows that here the word soul means a false sense or material consciousness. The command was a warning to beware not of Rome, Satan, nor of God, but of sin. Sickness, sin, and death are not concomitants of life or truth. No law supports them. They have no relation to God wherewith to establish their power. Sin makes its own hell, and goodness its own heaven. Such books as will rule disease out of mortal mind, and so efface the images and thoughts of disease, instead of impressing them with forcible descriptions and medical details, will help to abate sickness and to destroy it. Many a hopeless case of disease is induced by a single post-mortem examination, not from infection nor from contact with material virus, but from the fear of the disease and from the image brought before the mind. It is a mental state which is afterwards outlined on the body. The press unwittingly sends forth many sorrows and diseases among the human family. It does this by giving names to diseases and by printing long descriptions which mirror images of disease distinctly in thought. A new name for an ailment affects people like a Parisian name for a novel garment. Everyone hastens to get it. A minutely described disease costs many a man his earthly days of comfort. What a price for human knowledge! But the price does not exceed the original cost. God said of the tree of knowledge, which bears the fruit of sin, disease, and death, "In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." The less that is said of physical structure and laws, and the more that is thought and said about moral and spiritual law, the higher will be the standard of living, and the farther mortals will be removed from imbecility or disease. We should master fear instead of cultivating it. It was the ignorance of our forefathers in the departments of knowledge now broadcast in the earth that made them hardier than our trained physiologists, more honest than our sleek politicians. We are told that the simple food our forefathers ate helped to make them healthy. But that is a mistake. Their diet would not cure dyspepsia at this period. With rules of health in the head and the most digestible food in the stomach, there would still be dyspeptics. Many of the effeminate constitutions of our time will never grow robust until individual opinions improve and mortal belief loses some portion of its error. The doctor's mind reaches that of his patient. The doctor should suppress his fear of disease, else his belief in its reality and fatality will harm his patients even more than his calomel and morphine. For the higher stratum of mortal mind has in belief more power to harm man than the substratum matter. A patient hears the doctor's verdict as a criminal hears his death sentence. The patient may seem calm under it, but he is not. His fortitude may sustain him, but his fear, which has already developed the disease that is gaining the mastery, is increased by the physician's words. The materialistic doctor, though humane, is an artist who outlines his thought relative to disease and then fills in his delineations with sketches from textbooks. It is better to prevent disease from forming in mortal mind, afterwards to appear on the body. But to do this requires attention. The thought of disease is formed before one sees a doctor and before the doctor undertakes to dispel it by a counter-irritant, perhaps by a blister, by the application of caustic or croton oil, or by a surgical operation. Again, giving another direction to faith, the physician prescribes drugs until the elasticity of mortal thought haply causes a vigorous reaction upon itself and reproduces a picture of healthy and harmonious formations. A patient's belief is more or less molded and formed by his doctor's belief in the case, even though the doctor says nothing to support his theory. His thoughts and his patient's commingle, and the stronger thoughts rule the weaker. Hence the importance that doctors be Christian Scientists. Because the muscles of the blacksmith's arm are strongly developed, it does not follow that exercise has produced this result, or that a less used arm must be weak. If matter were the cause of action, and if muscles without volition of mortal mind could lift the hammer and strike the anvil, it might be thought true that hammering would enlarge the muscles. The trip hammer is not increased in size by exercise. Why not, since muscles are as material as wood and iron? Because nobody believes that mind is producing such a result on the hammer. Muscles are not self-acting. If mind does not move them, they are motionless. Hence the great fact that mind alone enlarges and empowers man through its mandate, by reason of its demand for and supply of power. Not because of muscular exercise, but by reason of the blacksmith's faith in exercise, his arm becomes stronger. Mortals develop their own bodies or make them sick according as they influence them through mortal mind. To know whether this development is produced consciously or unconsciously is of less importance than a knowledge of the fact. The feats of the gymnast prove that latent mental fears are subdued by him. The devotion of thought to an honest achievement makes the achievement possible. Exceptions only confirm this rule, proving that failure is occasioned by a too feeble faith. Had Blunden believed it impossible to walk the rope over Niagara's abyss of waters, he could never have done it. His belief that he could do it gave his thought forces, called muscles, their flexibility and power, which the unscientific might attribute to a lubricating oil. His fear must have disappeared before his power of putting resolve into action could appear. When Homer sang of the Grecian gods, Olympus was dark, but through his verse, the gods became alive in a nation's belief. Pagan worship began with muscularity, but the law of Sinai lifted thought into the Song of David. Moses advanced a nation to the worship of God in spirit instead of matter, and illustrated the grand human capacities of being bestowed by immortal mind. Whoever is incompetent to explain soul would be wise not to undertake the explanation of body. Life is, always has been, and ever will be independent of matter, for life is God, and man is the idea of God, not formed materially, but spiritually, and not subject to decay and dust. The psalmist said, "Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet." The great truth in the science of being, that the real man was, is, and ever shall be perfect, is incontrovertible. For if man is the image, reflection of God, he is neither inverted nor subverted, but upright and godlike. The suppositional antipode of divine infinite spirit is the so-called human soul or spirit. In other words, the five senses, the flesh that warreth against spirit. These so-called material senses must yield to the infinite spirit named God. St. Paul said, "For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." Christian Science says, "I am determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him glorified."